Hello, my name is Hamlet Dobbins, and this is Memphis Material, an oral history project chronicling the stories of the visual arts in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis Material is a podcast celebrating the personal histories, the intimate stories, and the studio practices of some of the people who help shape the creative landscape of our city. These unedited interviews are all recorded at the Memphis Listening Lab in the Crosstown Concourse. The website is designed by the wonderful Brian Dixon. Today's interview is with the artist and wearer of many hats, Carol DeForest. Carol DeForest was probably in the generation of artists that came before me. There is a group of artists who are my age, and our point of commonality is that at some point we worked for Carol DeForest in her studio. And so every once in a while I'll run into somebody who's about my age and I'll say, "Did you work for Carol DeForest?" And they'll be like, "Yeah, I did." And then we will also talk a lot about Carol and her dog, because she always has a big dog. So this interview with Carol was recorded on January 10th, 2023. Enjoy the interview. So if it's cool, I'm just going to steal from Krista Tippett, who has that great podcast. You ever listen to On Being?
Mm-hmm.
She has that great opening question. But instead of asking you about your earliest memory of faith or the role of faith in your childhood, will you, since our concern really is art, will you talk a little bit about your childhood and the role art played in it?
Sure, yeah. I grew up mostly in San Antonio, Texas,
okay. A
little bit in Corpus Christi. And the part in Corpus Christi, which was only 3 years, is essential to my development as an artist because I didn't know that I was in a very low-income school. It was in the 50s, and it was completely integrated. I didn't think about that kind of stuff. The first time I realized that the kids... This sounds like I was, you know, not playing with a full deck, but the first time I realized that there were black children in my school was when my classmate Brenda's dad came. I went home and said, "Guess what, Mother? Brenda's dad is a native." And she said, "What do you mean by that?" And I said, "You know, like Tarzan and the Natives, which we watched every afternoon."
Right.
And she said, "Well, that would be a black person. He's a black man." Why? Well, because Brenda's a black girl, young girl. So in that, you know, it was a time of great awakening. And it turned out, because we were a low-income school, the Junior League selected us as a school that needed help in the arts. So they came once a month and did a little workshop on an artist for about my third grade year. The artist that struck me, that I remember really well, was Diego Rivera. We had a lot of Mexican children in our class, and so that really hit me hard because of the whole idea of murals, that he was a Mexican man. We lived very near the border, and in that year, he died, and I am a child, and I'm cutting out of the newspaper, which I read every day also, not just my parents, "Stormy painter Diego Rivera dies." And I glued that in what I called my secret book. And in that book, I had things that I thought were secrets that were, actually, but also drawings and sketches and things like an article that I thought was interesting. And that was the beginning of being aware that there were other artists in the world. Mm. When we moved back to San Antonio, where I had lived as a kid too, we had many, many friends that were related to the arts. My dad was an Episcopal priest, and there were his parishioners, there were a whole bunch of people that were artists, so, or musicians or what have you. So from the get-go, I had these creative people around me. In my own family, my mother had put up all kinds of artwork, and not all of it was original artwork. Some of it was prints. But I knew, oh, that's a Van Gogh because the ladies from the Junior League taught me that in Corpus Christi. And so, you know, there were things that I could identify with. And at that time, our family was very troubled in some ways because my dad, who was very charismatic and fabulous guy, was also a closet alcoholic. Mm. My mother, he became so when my mother was very unwell with some health issues, and he started medicating with alcohol. So my deal was get out of the hot seat. And I would make what I called huts in under bushes or in the back alley.
Okay.
And they were made of cardboard and wood or whatever materials I had handy. But that was the beginning of making house shapes or working with mixed materials.
Okay, now, just to back up a little bit, so one thing I'm working on with this project is my ability to ask follow-up questions.
Okay.
And so, like, just out of curiosity, so, like, you mentioned Diego Rivera as someone who sparked your interest real early on. You talked about how located kind of close by, connections to where you are, more accessible in terms of the idea of location than, you know, like Van Gogh, who had been in Holland and mm-hmm. dead for many years.
Yeah.
And so, but what was it about, just out of curiosity, what was it, was there something about the work itself, the imagery that was in the work that was gripping for you, or was it more kind of this physicality?
It was a combination, I would say, of both, because he was a rebel. I mean, forget his political leanings towards communism or whatever. Forget that. That I was too young to tune into all that. But he was a rebel, and he was very egocentric, clearly. Mm-hmm. But he forged ahead and did all of these politically incorrect murals using the indigenous people. And I guess that was the first time I realized that, oh, okay, so like the American so-called Indians, these were the natives, quote-unquote, of Mexico.
Right.
So that it was a combination of social and the physicality of the paintings, the big, you know, swatches of paint and image in buildings like the government buildings and so forth. And it was fascinating to me that he was such a physically unattractive person.
Right.
Yeah. But very compelling, clearly.
Right, right. Okay. Now, thinking about these huts or these houses, mm-hmm. so like what kinds of materials did you say they were made out of? They were mostly just sort of cardboard and just sort of found pieces of wood?
Yeah. And at times, like right after Christmas, I would corral neighborhood children. This was an era when we actually played outside and had fun, and you roamed around all day long and all summer long and so forth, and you were fine. But we would get all the Christmas trees. And I remember the hut that we made that time. We tied the Christmas trees to a horizontal piece and then made a little kind of lever. And so you could get in the hut by pulling on the lever, and it would lift up all these Christmas trees, and you could kind of crawl in. And it was made of cardboard and wood and Christmas trees. I mean, these things were temporary, to put it mildly.
Right.
They were going to disintegrate, clearly.
Right. Now, this is something that came immediately to mind, and so it was a thing that, and you were sort of made an allusion to, you know, present work or things that you've thought about recently. Mm-hmm. And so when was it that became solid in your mind? Like for me, Legos were always important to me. Legos have kind of been a part of my, like, hi, I'm Hamlet and I make paintings and Legos are really important to me. And that was mostly from writing a master's thesis and like sitting down and being like, whoa, where did all of this start? So what about for you? Like, was this story of childhood Carol, mm-hmm. was that something that was consistent throughout, or was that something that it dawned on you later, like in the making?
I would say in the making, like actually at U of M, when I got into the graduate program there, I had Harris Sorrell actually said to me, what I notice about your work, these dwellings, is that they're the size of your head. Mm. And what I'm thinking is they are your head. They're what you're thinking about and so forth. And I thought, wow. I mean, it sounds silly to not to be able to have that be a revelation, but it was.
Right, right.
And I loved that. And so I carried that with me from then on.
Okay.
And, you know, apropos of it. But after the huts, the other angle was also in Corpus Christi, because it was a beach town. Our mother would take us to the beach often. It was a great way to deal with children, you know, let them loose. And there were great things on the beach, like treasure. Rope, shells, pieces of plastic, pieces of driftwood, etc. So we gathered that stuff. The rest of the kids were looking mostly for seashells, and I was looking for what I now call loot, just bounty from the sea. What can you do with it? Hey, this looks like a donkey head. Hey, this looks like, you know, a ship, la, 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 la. So it kept going in a real roundabout way, the huts and that loot from the beach that were somehow intertwined with Latin culture, which I was right in the middle of. Even though I'm a gringa, I was in the middle of a town that was half Mexican-American, and the culture was potent, and they use everything. There's no waste. Like in Latin America, it's very disturbing to see what's happening on the border right now, but in Latin America, Mexico, Guatemala, or wherever, if there's a box on the street of cardboard, a decent one, it's gone like that because people have use for it. Then they'll use it. A tin can that tomatoes came in is immediately, after emptying and using for food, painted bright pink, bright purple, blue, and flowers are planted in it. And that culture was very vibrant in San Antonio. So I saw that. And the combination of sounds more like something of today, you know, reusing materials.
Right.
Very current. But it was on my mind back then. Maybe not as that, but you can find treasure everywhere.
Right. And it wasn't just, like, for example, it wasn't just that that material was there, but it was also that there was a sense of its potency as fodder, you know, like this isn't just stuff that we're gonna take home and reuse, but it's a like a kind of fodder that I might be able to use in these things that I want to make, or you know, you're seeing something that's happening in there. But like, there's a step between the functionality of some of those things, you know, like rope obviously can be reused, blah, 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 but like the things that made that move from the land of use to the land of art. And so, like, for you, was it just always there, or was that something that you picked up through school? Like, the idea of taking these things and making art with them as opposed to tying things down in the truck or whatever?
Yeah. I did not use them for practical things.
Okay.
So I would say it was very unconscious, the use of them in the huts or whatever else I was making. And I would, like, gosh, this is so weird to think about this. I would pick up little ice cream spoons. They're made of wood, and they're shaped like a person generally. And I would pick those up on the playground and take them home and draw faces on them and make outfits out of debris, you know, paper or a little material or something. So clearly that kind of thought was there, although I wasn't thinking. Now I think, cool, yeah, I want to make art out of that.
Right, right.
But not then.
Now, what about, you were talking about your family, you know, your father as a minister, and then your mother having health issues. I can't remember, are you an only child, or do you have siblings?
No, I have an older brother and two sisters, younger sisters.
Okay.
And our mother was an English teacher forever after she recovered from her illnesses as a young woman. And so there were books always, lots of books. Everyone in my family, with the exception of yours truly, can play multiple musical instruments. I am literally the only one in the family that doesn't play guitar, piano, dulcimer, accordion, or whatever.
What do you think it was? What kept you from doing it? Are you just defective?
I think so. I think that so at some point someone told me if you're good at math, you're usually good at music.
Okay.
And that wasn't until I was way into adulthood. I was taking piano for the third time. Each time I took it, my teacher said after about a year, our father's favorite expression when we had done something incredibly stupid and poorly, he would say, your gifts do not lie in this area. And so my gifts do not lie in that area. And my first piano teacher told my parents, why don't you save your money and spend it on this kid, Catherine, who's very gifted, and forget about Carol. And it was, I couldn't coordinate mental and this. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, me either.
Really?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's like anytime I see someone playing music or see someone reading music or thinking about music, it is just like a superpower to me. Like even just singing is a superpower to me. I mean, it's such a beautiful thing and such a mystery to me.
And you can take it anywhere, like Pinckney going to Vietnam and pulling out a harmonica.
Right, right.
It's a universal music, communication.
Right.
Yeah.
And so thinking about that, though, was there encouragement for the making of things in your house? Like what, I mean, you talk about this sort of like going out and finding places to play and sort of building these things. What about like what we would normally think of as like traditional arts, like drawing and painting and...
It was encouraged, but we had zero extra money. Four children. Like my dad's income when I left for college, which was in 67, his income was $13,000 a year, four children, two in college at a time. My mother's was $4,800. Are you kidding me?
Right.
There was literally no money. I wanted desperately to take art lessons, and we... at the McNay, what's now an art museum in San Antonio, we simply couldn't afford it. I think it was $50 a month,
right?
But it was impossible. So what my parents did instead, we were very fortunate in our school district. We had amazing art teachers.
Okay.
So that sort of ameliorated my disappointment.
Okay.
And they were very encouraging to me always, my parents, as were the teachers.
Okay.
So I was considered an art kid.
Okay, now talk a little bit more about this junior league. I mean, in terms of being exposed to art at a really early age, I'm curious about that. So, like, what form did that take? Like, how was it a teaching supplement that the teachers had? Was it someone who would come through? What form did it take?
The teacher would say, let's say, Wednesdays are going to be our art day.
Okay.
And the women from the junior league would come in. They would show slides of whatever artist, you know, Diego Rivera finally is the one I remember. So, well, Van Gogh, too. But they would show slides. They would talk about that artist's work just extemporaneously. And we would do stuff. Let's say, you know, I don't recall doing a mural, but we probably did.
Okay.
They probably put paper up and we painted on it and so forth. We were encouraged to write about that person, too. So it was, it was very, for that era, for the 50s, it was pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking back on it, I think it's much more remarkable than I knew at the time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even thinking about the things that we have in place now in our public school system. And so that was there in San Antonio, Corpus Christi.
Yeah.
And then what about, how did you make the jump from, you know, being this person who would mostly only take art classes at school and then sort of have this time to make things on your own as a kind of... an escape, mm-hmm. or a solace-seeking tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you make, what was the transition from this elementary school to high school like?
It was arduous because the girls and young guys that I knew that were artists, art students, art kids, were almost without exception painters, drawers, etc. I wasn't that, and I knew that, and I didn't know how to make what I was doing important, and I struggled with the kind of drawing that I do is very loose and mostly contour drawings, what I prefer. And Vita Reed was the person that finally gave me permission at the Art Academy to go with that.
Okay.
And so it was hard. I didn't apply to the Art Academy when I was in high school because the portfolio was 10 examples of two-dimensional work. I didn't have 10 that I thought were strong enough to send. So I applied to Southwestern Rhodes instead.
Now, how did you, I mean, I know from working at Rhodes mm-hmm. that there is an underground pipeline that leads from Texas to Rhodes College, but I think that's probably because of some guidance counselors or something. But how did you, as a kid in Corpus Christi/San Antonio, know about Rhodes College?
Well, I was born in Tennessee, okay. in Sewanee, when my dad was in seminary.
Okay.
Consequently, I had this romantic idea that I should go explore my roots. And I mean, nobody said you should go explore your roots. But when people would say, oh, were you born here? I would say, no, I was born in Tennessee. And of course, everybody knew Davy Crockett and all that nonsense, and the right. Alamo, the volunteers that came and so forth. And so I wanted to see what is it? What's it like? You know, so forth. And I had only passed through Memphis a few times in my life, like maybe twice. Our grandmother lived in near Asheville, so we would come through occasionally to go see her, not necessarily always this route because it was very long from San Antonio. It was a three-day drive in those days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
I mean, it's a long drive now, but that's a long drive.
Yeah, and so I didn't know what the school looked like. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know a living soul who went here. And I got here. My dad drove me up here, and he got ready to leave the instant we unpacked. And I said, Daddy, don't leave me. My roommate's not even here. And he said, Honey, you chose this. You have to live with it now. And of course, now I think he was probably upset. And going, here's my baby leaving. I'm out of here. And he said, I've got to get back home. It's a long way. And to be honest, my mother's father died the day before. So it was a time of great trauma.
Yeah.
You know, my mother left. I woke up on the day I'm supposed to go to, day before I'm supposed to leave for college. My father said, you have to get up. He was from Boston. Mummer's gone. And I said, what? And he said, Granddaddy died. And so, you know, it was just like this uproar. You're enough emotionally hoop-de-doo with going to college the next day. And I said, well, who's going to take me? And he said, well, I am. And, you know, so.
Now, what year was this?
67.
Okay, so you're making the move from Texas in 1967. Obviously, like when we're in high school, most kids in high school aren't really thinking about the world. But, like, in high school, when you were a senior, was this something that you were, I think in 67, you kind of had to be aware of the world. So, like, what was your understanding of the world in 1967 when you were a senior?
Okay, so I had one of the greatest things and most influential in my life. When I was 17 the year before, I was chosen to be an exchange student in a Volkswagen-sponsored. 100 Americans go to Germany, 100 German kids come and live with our families.
Okay.
And it changed my life forever, thankfully, which was it gave me permission to be different than the status quo. It gave me permission to really go ahead and embrace who I was. And living in a different culture, going to museums in Europe. My family there took me on trips, like a vacation. We went to Italy. We went to Switzerland, Austria, so forth. So it was extraordinary. And in addition to that, I would get on a train with kids from my town and go places. And it was freeing. So when, and my parents said, oh, you can't do this because we can't have this young girl come stay in our house. And I said, you cannot take this from me. This is mine.
Yeah.
We're going to do it.
Right.
Because they chose Texas, they chose San Antonio, and then they chose my high school, and then they chose me. So it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And there were two kids that I, one boy from Memphis and a girl who ended up in college with me. She was from New Orleans, but there she was. When I got to college, I went, holy cow, Susie. You know, we had known each other in Germany. So.
Right. Now, how long was this in Germany?
We were just there for like 2.5 months.
Okay.
The summer. It was a weird program because it was just the summer.
Okay, and that was kind of in between junior year and senior year?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this whole civil rights thing blew sky high within 6 months of my arrival in Memphis.
Right.
And it was evident that if you, I'm looking up there, it says, let's get serious. If you're going to get serious, you need to tune in. You know, you need to, if you care about a cause, you better show your support.
Right.
And so I got involved in civil rights and anti-war stuff and at Southwestern Rhodes.
Okay. Now, and so you arrive, and you're almost immediately on your own. What was the environment there at Southwestern like in the late 1960s?
Girls were not allowed to wear trousers or shorts except to and from athletic events. It literally said that in the little pamphlet.
Okay.
That'll get you started. Then you had to be in at X o'clock. I don't remember whether it was midnight or 10, but one or the other. And we would get in and then jump out our balcony, you know, baloney like that. But it was backwards. It was conservative. But there was this rumble under the surface because it was the 60s and things were going on and we knew about everything, you know, that was going on. The war, which was when, at that point, when I was in junior high, Walter Cronkite said, if this war continues as we expect, the kids that are in junior high now will be in college before it ends.
Mm.
That resonated with me because I was there. I mean, the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred while I was in junior high. San Antonio had 7 military bases. Where the big issue was, among a lot of young girls, was should we lose our virginity now because we're going to be goners in a few months because
right.
the Russians are going to blow us to smithereens. I mean, it was actually talked about. And, I mean, which sounds harebrained, but, like, live a little because we're going to die.
Right.
I mean, that was an issue.
Right. Wow. Okay, so a lot of points in there. So, but thinking about Southwestern, you were talking about how conservative it was. What about the art program? Like, you knew that you wanted to be in an art class, art major,
mm-hmm.
And you came to Southwestern. And so what was it like there? Who was there?
It was an incredible time. Lon Anthony, who's a sculptor.
Yep.
Murray Reese would come in and teach classes. Mary Sims was our painting teacher. Biff Elrod was eventually there. Peter Bowman was eventually there. And they had a reciprocal program with the Art Academy. Kids from the Academy could take classes at Southwestern for no fee, additional fee. We could take classes there. So I took pottery from a guy named Fred Lincoln, who was one of Peter Sonjan's students. And Peter was around. I had him kind of as an adjunct. I mean, he wanted to make sure Fred was doing things correctly. I had Murray for photography. So right away, I knew I had that resource. Lon was not there my first year. And at first, because of the encouragement of my parents and the fears of my parents, I was a language major because when I was in Germany, I learned to speak German.
Mm.
And when I was growing up from a kid on, little child on, I took Spanish, so I was fairly fluent in Spanish. And so my father, being very scared, oh, no, 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 don't go into the arts, don't do that. You could be, his idea of Nirvana was travel agent.
Okay. Okay, so you just listed a huge group of people who are no longer around. Murray is still here, but a lot of those people are no longer here. Will you talk a little bit about Lon Anthony as a teacher?
Yeah, I mean, when I went to sign up for his class, I could see him in his, he was welding something. And I looked in there in his office or his own studio, and I said, that is what I want to be, that, what that man is.
Right.
And he was such a wonderful teacher because his teaching was not just in the classroom or not just about art. It was a whole approach to life, the way you live, the way you eat, the way you dress, the way you think, the way you read. It was everything. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker, and still do to this day.
Now, was that something you had seen before, like in terms of thinking about high school teachers? Like, obviously, the high school art teachers are kind of the weirdos, you know, and they're sort of the black sheep of the crew. But, like, was that something that you had ever seen before, the kind of thing that you were seeing with Lon?
I had only in, we had a family friend named Caroline Shelton, who was this wonderful watercolorist, and she was also the head of the art department at Josky's of Texas, which was the equivalent of Goldsmith's here.
Okay.
And I knew that Caroline dressed fabulously, looked amazing, did these fabulous paintings, and was a woman with a job in art. Mm. I worked for her eventually. But that she was probably the only person I knew I could see, you know, how she lived, and it was I would never use the word artsy. It just makes me gag. I always want to slug people when they say, yeah, I could tell you're an artist because you're artsy. I just think, well. But she was living, breathing her aesthetic. And I feel like I am. I mean, I'm the way I live is extremely important to me, to make an atmosphere that I can walk into. This is Lon Anthony. We went to his house for some gathering, and when I walked in, I thought, whoa. I mean, there was, of course, a lot of art on the walls, boheme, you know, cloths thrown over furniture and so forth and so on. And I didn't see it as people, his then wife was a dancer, Betsy, and she taught dance at U of M, and I didn't see it as it was kind of a boheme thing that was hip and cool. It was a part of who they were and what they did, every bit of it.
Right.
And
it was just an extension.
Yeah, exactly. And not a pretense at all. And I loved that. I felt like that was, and that's the way Lon was with us, total immersion into the aesthetics of living and your work. And he did push us and introduce us and so forth into all kinds of things, like going to a foundry and going to an army surplus place to buy cool stuff that we could either wear or use in our work or whatever. And he was just, he's a brilliant man. He's just a lovely human. And so that was the first. And other people, like Mary, was when she, we had what we call the art shacks in those days, that were over where some of the new, like the theater and the new girls' dorms are, over that direction. And they were Quonset huts from World War II.
Okay.
And that they were fabulous. That's where we did our classes. So here's Mary coming in. She had been in Chicago at the Art Institute, and she came in. The first time I saw her, she had, unfortunately, because it killed her later, was a cigarette in her hand and her hair tied up in a turban. And she was like, And I thought, whoa.
And kind of glamorous.
Yes, very. Okay. And yet, funny. Oh, my God, she was funny. Smart alecky, and yet, cut to the chase. Let's not bullshit about this. I want to see more work from you. Or that's an interesting way of painting. Do you know Vita Reed's work? No. Well, go to the Art Academy. There's a show of her work. Go look at it because it resonates, and it will resonate with you, that kind of thing. And she was very definitely a seriously good teacher. So we had Lon, we had Mary. When Mary went on maternity leave, we had Eleanor Lux, who's an artist that lives in Arkansas, in Fayetteville, I think, Eureka Springs, actually. And Eleanor is a 3D person. She works with junky stuff that, honestly, even though I love her dearly, I don't like. It's too kitschy and too, I don't know how to say, just too scatological at times for me.
Okay.
And we had Dorothy Ross for art history, who was a fabulous person, even though I just couldn't get with art history at that time. Hmm. She would do dramatic stuff, like say, and in this landscape, we have the trees, you know, painted by Cezanne in this way because, you know, la, la, la. But those people, if you throw in Murray to that, and you throw in Peter Bowman, and you throw in Biff Elrod, Biff was our teacher who was very much of a realist painter. And amazingly enough, he used us, the students, as his models. Mm. And when he asked me if I would model for him, I said, yeah, well, sure, of course. I had no idea that he meant nude. Mm. And so when I got there, which was at school, of course he'd be arrested now.
Sure, yeah.
I was 21, and I didn't know whether he kept that kind of stuff in mind, but he did. And so he did 3 or 4 paintings of me, a couple of which he showed at a show he had, like maybe in April before we graduated. Mm. And the dean of the college, Jameson Jones, said, nice painting. And I thought, uh-oh, because Biff had agreed with me not to show more than about, a little slice of my face.
Right.
But Jameson recognized it. So here's the dean of the school knowing that students had posed for him.
Right.
But like, oh, well, it was a different time.
Right.
And he wasn't predatory at all. I mean, it wasn't like,
sure,
oh, hey, babe, just take off your clothes and let's, you know, go from there. It wasn't that way at all. So, but we knew that he took photographs and then projected them and painted from there. And he's you know, been a very prolific and successful painter in New York for many years. So we were branded by these different really remarkable artists.
Now, that's a lot of teachers. I mean, I know that you guys, you also had access to the MCA stable or mm-hmm. the group of teachers that are over there, but that's a lot of teachers. Like right now, I think Rhodes is a painter, a sculptor, and then a kind of a floater that sort of covers other areas. And so that's a really broad spectrum. But just to back up just a little bit, like one of the things that's interesting for me about thinking about when someone gets ignited or excited, you know, about something like you were talking about with Lon, were there things about his work that were also exciting, or was it mostly sort of this mystique?
That, good question. It was definitely his work as well. I mean, his work was primarily figurative, if not exclusively. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He found great humor in people.
Right.
And he, when I first met him, he had a hair lip which had been not very well repaired. Mm. By the time a few years had passed, he had clearly had plastic surgery and better, you know, care and so forth. But he did funny-looking people, and I think it came from being a kid with a hair lip and he would always put big noses on the characters and skinny little legs and arms and so forth. And he, but very humorous and expressive, all of that work was. Some of it was, he would do women that were zoftig, big bosomy, big rear ends and so forth. And so it was like giving you permission to make fun of the serious, actually, and just be, you know, smart alecky about it. And I did figurative work in those days.
Right. Now, and then also kind of thinking about that in terms of thinking about school, like the teachers are a thing, but then also the community of fellow students and colleagues is also a big part of that. And I know one of the things that's really powerful about Southwestern / Rhodes is that there's a lot of cross-pollination. How did you find the student experience there? Was it a competitive environment? Was it a cordial one? Like, how did it work with your classmates?
It was very divided. It was the bohemes and the frats.
Uh-huh.
And you were either, I mean, I was floating along my freshman year with ribbons to match my outfits.
Right.
I mean, not that I'm so different now, maybe,
right.
But little Capizio shoes and so forth. And keep in mind, we couldn't wear trousers until
right.
maybe the next year. But so I knew that I became friends with a bunch of writers.
Mm.
The guys that were the newspaper editors and so forth became my friends, partly because we were all involved in civil rights and anti-war.
Okay.
Carrie Fowler was one of our beloved friends then and now, who started the seed bank in Svalbard, Norway, and worked for the UN for many years. He's now works for the State Department in food issues for the world. Gee, what a great time to be dealing with that, and on and on and on. But that group of people were from all over the place. They were, when I first got there, I thought, wow, this is really bizarre, because these kids are from little towns that their last name is the name of that town.
Right.
And many of them are the first person in their family to go to college.
Right.
Which blew my mind, because both of my parents had gone to college, and on my mother's side, both of her parents had gone to college and or more. And my father's parents were immigrants from the West Indies, so they had come from, you know, a other totally different culture to Boston to live, but they didn't go to college, but all of his siblings did.
Mm.
So it was inconceivable to me that people weren't going to college.
Mm.
So that was a shock. And then the black culture was so different, and yet the music of the black culture was very, very big. My father's friend owned the black radio station in San Antonio. At that time, R&B and soul music were coming on, but people were not, they didn't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have us come down and pick albums out that we wanted. We could just take a stack. So when I got here, I had Sonny Boy Williamson, Booker White, etc. And those people were alive and would come to Southwestern to do concerts.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It was phenomenal. And so that little group of writers and bohemes and civil rights anti-war folks were the ones that got those people here to play for the students.
Now, what was the student body like? Was it mostly white, like in the way that it was maybe when I first started working at Rhodes in the early aughts?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, but, and so now we sort of think of Rhodes as this sort of gated enclave, but you know, at that time there were no gates, and what was the interaction with the outside world or with the greater Memphis population?
It was limited, extremely limited. It was still like a little ivory tower, and it was, I mean, the administration was trying to keep it from blowing sky high. You know, imagine that after King was assassinated, we had tanks going up and down University to keep the area safe. And that is mind-boggling. And they were trying to keep the lid on us, the kids, the students, and yet be responsible, because they knew we were going downtown to march with King and the sanitation workers and so forth. And they would let it be known, these are the safe ways to do that. Mm-hmm. And they would tell, like, the guys that were the editors of the paper, tell the students if they take the this bus to get off at this place and to walk in, don't try to take a bus all the way to the actual starting point of these marches and so forth. And we were also very aware that there were a lot of people on campus, like frat boy types that were, you know, KAs that were super racist. And that was appalling to me because of my, well, because of my background as a child of a minister and going to these schools that were, I mean, we never even thought about integration because it was there. I mean, the Latino children, our high school kids in our district, were very specific looking. The boys had a specific look, white shirts, khaki trousers, pointy black shoes, and, you know, ducktail slicked back hairdos. And their parents, with few exceptions, worked at the cement plant right down the street from our high school. So they were known as the Cementville kids. Mm. If they spoke Spanish in school, they were suspended. Now, if you are a teacher in that district and you do not speak Spanish, you are suspended.
Right.
You have to be bilingual or you can't be hired,
right,
which is kind of good justice, a teensy bit too late. But so here we are in Memphis, and it's this, we know by living it, we're in a racist community, we're in a pro-war community. What we're trying to do is very unpopular.
And then thinking about that, like, did that shape some of the curriculum? Was that present in the kinds of work that you were making as a student?
Definitely. It was, I was doing, like, one piece I did after Kent State is of four people wrapped in the American flag. And it's just a very small piece. But, and, you know, they're suffering. And I did all these kind of, as my father said, do you ever do anything that's happy?
Right.
And, it was a wild time. I mean, imagine this, that if you had been there and you either made a D or an F and got and flunked out, or you had a low draft number, God help
right.
you, you were out.
Yeah.
You were drafted.
Right.
So you knew the whole time that you were going to be fodder for the cannons, literally.
Right.
The second you graduated. And right. that was stressful.
Right.
Tremendously stressful. And, you know, and people were, when I think about how naive we were, it's kind of like crushing sadness that I feel about how naive we were. But we were very sincere in our stance.
Right.
And one of the ironies of life is that I now make a so-called humanitarian award every year. I didn't know until a couple of years ago, that 3 years ago, that it was the Martin Luther King Humanitarian Award. I've been making it for over 20 years. That year, 3 years ago, they called me. Usually it's one per year. It's a little statuette. They said they wanted 38. And I said, oh, really? I mean, seriously? And they said, yeah, we're going to give one to each of the still living men who were in the strike in 1968. And that was tremendously moving to me because, among other things, I have to put a little, you know, brass plaque on that's the name of that person. So I'm looking at Hamlet Dobbins, and that isn't just a cipher. That's a person
right.
that I marched with in 1968, let's say.
Right.
I mean, it was intense. And I, you know, I have my I Am a Man poster. I still have it. Because I'm a saver. I'm going to pick right. stuff, right?
Well, I was going to ask, is that because you were aware of that importance at the time?
Or no.
It's just that you're a super saver? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's cool. That's nothing wrong with being a super saver.
And one of them sold for $38,000 okay. in the last few years at Sotheby's.
Okay.
So I keep thinking, well, maybe that's my retirement account. Right.
Okay, so one question we haven't really gotten to yet, and I think it's interesting that you've talked a lot about the different teachers, you know, Lon is a sculptor, thinking about ceramics, thinking about painting. What was it physically about the making that was interesting to you? You know, like a lot of times when I talk to my students, when I ask them about, like, why do they make art, you know, they go to the gush of the oil paint or the, you know, the mush or the tactile quality of the clay. Was there something tactile, something physical in the act of making, or was it more of a kind of psychological building?
I'd say both. It's because the psychological part is it takes you out of your normal realm.
Right.
It transports you. The physical part is that you or I or whomever is capable of putting something in the world that did not exist before. And a painting, a sculpture, a pot, or what have you. And whether I was listening to some program about musicians the other night, and that was part of it, that the musician who wrote a lot of the scores for movies that had gotten Oscars just said, you know, it's all out here. And you just gather it in and turn it into something. And that's definitely how I feel. And if what I've said too, like apropos of the era that you worked with me in my studio, we knew what those were going to look like before we even started one. With the art, what I call the art with a capital A, I never know. I'm as surprised as anybody. Even if I say, well, here's an idea, a nest, or a what does it look like to hang out your dirty linen? What is and for me, it comes from phrases and words, always. Mm-hmm. So like nest, what does that look like? Dirty linen, what does that look like? Tornado or whatever it might be, it's this phrase. What does that look like? And then I start working with materials, and I have a lot of what Baron, my husband, thinks is J-U-N-K in my studio. He says, oh, my God, if you got rid of all this shit, you would have all kinds of space in here, la, la, la.
Right.
But that's fodder. That's the loot. You know, I want to be able to be surprised. And so I'll open up a bin that's full. It's categorized, you know. Paper stuff, plastic stuff.
I mean, okay.
It's obsessive compulsive baloney. But
now you did talk a little bit about, like, before when you would find things on the beach, you know, you would find something and then that thing would lead you, donkey head or whatever it was, mm-hmm. would lead you in a place. And so I would imagine that in some ways that kind of that surprise and also the revealing of that thing could also be a kind of spark or a kind of impetus or beginning point mm-hmm. for you. And so, like, part of, like you were saying, tornado, nest, et cetera, but also it seems like having these objects around is also a place where things begin to spark.
Yeah, and if for example, I'm thinking of something that I had in a show you curated at one time at Martial Arts, I found on a beach a flat, white wooden leg that had apparently come from a whirligig because it had a little hole where you would have put a screw and it could move. And my father had just died, and I kept thinking about stuff like how we describe death, the so-called passing away, which is too passive for me. Died, that's harsh, that's hard. But then you go, bought the farm, kicked the bucket, etc. And so I went, kick the bucket, huh? That little leg could be attached to something and you could kick the bucket. And I was driving down my then street, Lafayette Street, and I found a bucket all squashed on the street with red coming out of it, red paint. And I thought, wow, score. Kick the bucket. And so that was about my father dying, but it had the humor in it, like it was okay to make fun of it, you know, like Lon Anthony or Mary Sims.
Okay, so thinking about this in terms of that impulse to build and then also to kind of create a space for stories to happen, was that something that was something that you just sort of carried with you from childhood into school, and you just happened to be with these people who were also interested in that kind of thing? Like, what kinds of things do you feel like you pulled from, like, say, for example, Lon or Mary?
I think it was there, and they assisted in the pulling out, and the they made it okay to do that. And at first I didn't. I mean, you know, I cast things in bronze and made clay Biafran child images, so forth and so on. But later it started morphing into that. At the Art Academy, I worked for 5 years after Southwestern and then went back to the Art Academy because I had not gone to graduate school because I didn't think I knew enough. And I didn't get it that's where you get the enough.
Right.
You hope to. And so I went to the Art Academy, started kind of from scratch. I was given credit for 1 year of art, and I had a lot of art. And so that was very disturbing, but it was good ultimately.
Okay, now what was going on at the Art Academy at the time? Like, who was over there?
John Seyfried, John McIntyre in sculpture,
right.
Peter Sonjan in clay. And for some reason, I went more into Peter's world than John and John's world. I was in their world. I took classes from both of them, but it didn't... Seyfried was casting stuff in resin. McIntyre was a carver, and I'm an additive person. Mm-hmm. And I think as sculpture, you are one or the other. You either take away or you add on.
Okay.
And that may be too simplistic, but I think it's true.
Right.
And so in clay, I could add, you know, roll it out, add, make little houses, make things about life and what was going on and so forth. And so I had those guys, those three men, and Vita, Bob Reisling, Ted Fairs.
Oh, my goodness.
Huge deal. He was extraordinary. He was very low-key, very quiet, incredible man. And he would say, he would set up the world's most banal and hideous still lifes. And I would go, Mr. Fairs, we would never have called him Ted. Uh-huh. We did call the other people by their name, but not him.
Right.
And I would say, this is so horrible. And he would go, yep. And then you'd finally get it. He wants you to take that much of it and make that the star of whatever you painted or drew.
Okay.
And so it was like, eureka. You don't have to do the whole thing.
Right. Now, okay, so like all of that stuff is good. So one thing I'm curious about as a teacher is how did you figure out that was what he was interested in? I mean, that seems like one of those things where maybe 1% of the students would click for them. But just out of curiosity, like what did Ted, I'm curious as a teacher, is like what did he do that was so great?
He let you make the mistake over and over and over and over. And he would say, well, that's a pretty weak effort, because you've got colors that are the literal color of the pieces, and you can use any color.
Right.
So you can take it from the banal to the elevated by using color in a different way, and you would go, okay. And it would take you a good few weeks to get over the nervousness of being with this man. And one thing he would say is, come to my studio. I have tons of art. If you want something, come to the studio and get it. And, I mean, you know, buy it very cheaply. And I think, why in heaven's name didn't I do that?
Right.
But I guess I thought he was going to live forever.
Well, I mean, I think one thing for me that's sort of interesting in terms of the way you're talking about his class is that I would imagine that it would take a little while, like you were saying, that some people were intimidated and it sort of took them a little while to get past that. What do you think it was? Was it just time that eventually got people to see things the way that he was seeing them? Or would people just walk out of there and they'd just be like, oh, this is not a good class?
I think it was time, but I also think it was, in those days, the school, you were expected to work out of class also,
okay,
a fair amount. And you would never just go home and chill and watch movies. Never. Our peers would just go, where were you last night? And if you said, well, you know, I had dinner with my aunt and uncle, they would go, yeah, and after that, you didn't come back here and work? That was the atmosphere. It wasn't exactly competitive when you were asking about Southwestern. It wasn't so much competitive as at Southwestern as it was sort of, I think always it's been morally driven. If you are truly a moral and responsible citizen, what are you doing? You're drinking beer at the frat house? Why aren't you on the streets, man, if you believe, you know, da-da-da? And at the Art Academy, it was, oh, you want to be an artist?
Mm.
Put your hours in. There's no way you could make it through at that time without putting in the hours.
Right.
And so if you put in the hours, you eventually go, okay, yeah, he wants... What he's trying to pull out of us is to really see what it could be if you isolate the interesting part and put colors and so forth that resonate,
right,
and make it alive.
Okay. Now, and then thinking about that, and then also just like a heads up,
yeah,
in about 5 minutes, my alarm will go off,
yeah,
and then I'll need to like push some buttons over here. And so... Yeah. If we want to do this some more, you're welcome to come in another time.
Okay.
But we're not obviously going to get to 1983 today. But like thinking about that though, what was the, you were talking about the community in the studio, like were there some other people there that were really important and pivotal for you to be around? Like for me, there were a handful of really great people when I was in school. And so was it that way for you, or mm-hmm, was it... Well, talk about some of those folks.
One of them that became a mentor to me was a guy at that time known as Bobby Gallott, a.k.a. Robert Gio, that was an extraordinary sculptor. He later went to Yale, and unfortunately he's now deceased, but... He would fixate on a sculptor or just an artist of some sort out in the world, and he would start delving into that person's work, and then he would do a version of what that was. They were more cartoony kind of things, which is not something I am particularly interested in, but what Bobby did from that was potent, really beautifully crafted work, exquisitely crafted. He after Yale, he became a model maker in New York for architects and just did fabulous stuff and very eccentric, weird, gloppy-looking sculptures, kind of like sterling ruby, kind of the, you know how he does those gloppy kind of pots? Galat did something similar, but in different materials and small scale. Other people, there were some, well, there was a guy named James Little, who now has just been in the Whitney Biennial and had that show at Dixon. And James was there the first year I was there. And he was another one of those people who was no bullshit. He was smart, hardworking, and was going to make it, by God. James was going to make it. He knew it, he said it, and he did it. And I think who else? There were people, well, like Dale Baucom was one of, Bert Sharp was around. The couple of them were there when I was a student at Southwestern. They were there when I took pottery, for example, at the Art Academy as a, you know, we could, you know, I told you we could just take classes there. I mean, we got credit for them and so forth. There were a bunch of people that were the famous former. Carol Todd was one of them. He was there before I got there. Karen Blockman was one of them.
Huh, okay.
And so those two and James and Dale Baucom and Bert Sharp were kind of famous, just recently former students. And there were there was a whole group. There were Peggy Barton was my friend Margaret Barton's mother, and she was a painter. And James and they had a little rat pack of painters that were tight and really hardworking and did what I thought was great work. So there were student mentors that were important. And even though I was in clay, I mean, Sanjan said, heck, I don't know anything about what you're, what the kind of clay work you want to do. I'm a potter. Why don't you go to Memphis State? And I said, I'm here. And he said, well, you need to take classes. So I took classes from Niles Wallace and Nancy White way back then and was grateful that he sent me that direction. And because they were both doing sculpture. Niles was throwing pots a lot. Well, they both did. But they both had a little wacky side thing going on.
Right.
So...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's just pause it there. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Hang on. Let me just click this little button here.
And that was the first of three interviews I did with Carol DeForest. This one was recorded on January 10th, 2023.